Mark Sobel. I'm U.S. Chairman of OMFIF. Today I have the great honor and joy to be joined for a discussion on yesterday's FOMC with Louis Alexander. Louis is the chief U.S. economist at Nomura. Prior to that, Louis worked with Secretary Geithner at the Treasury in the midst of the global financial crisis, working on financial stability issues and doing the initial groundwork to set up the Office of Financial Research. He was a former chief economist at Citi and the Commerce Department. And he was also a very distinguished leading thinker and economist in the International Financial Section of the Federal Reserve, where I first started dealing with Louis decades ago. So it's a great joy to see Louis Alexander today. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And as you said, we've known each other a long time.
So my expectation for the FOMC was that it would be on hold yesterday, but I expected a lot of agonizing over signs of the stalling economy, given the upturn in coronavirus cases and the uncertainties of the end July fiscal cliff. So I was looking for a dovish hold. Is that what you feel Mr. Powell and his colleagues delivered yesterday?
Yeah, I think so. Look, they did add a sentence to the statement that acknowledged the risks around the virus. I don't think that was terribly surprising. And certainly in Powell's comments, he emphasized again and again that public health is important to the economic outlook in this context. And clearly the surge in cases we've had since the beginning of June is something that is worrying for the near-term economic outlook. He also emphasized the importance of fiscal policy. Again, I don't think that's a surprise given things I've said since the COVID-19 outbreak hit, but it is very much along those lines. So they clearly are concerned, and I think they're going to continue to do what they can to support the economy, but they do think we need more on the fiscal side.
It really seems as if the U.S. outlook right now is very uncertain. But on the other hand, one could maybe think that the FOMC was perhaps focusing with a view towards a September meeting, that that might be a better time to roll out some new thinking or new monetary policy statements. How do you feel about that?
No, I think they are clearly indicating that they're thinking about doing more, but they're not quite ready to do it now. I think they are clearly putting themselves in a position where they can take action in September if they feel they need to. I have to say the way Powell framed things yesterday suggested to me that it's coming, and I still think September is the most likely time. But I certainly think it's possible that it could actually even take longer than that. One of the answers that I thought was interesting was he was asked about the relative timing of the completion of their review of long-term strategy and rolling out these new policy initiatives. And he did indicate that the strategy review was likely to come first. If you think about that timing, that does suggest the possibility that we'll get the strategy review in September and potentially policy decisions later than that. It's still our expectation that we get the policy decisions in September too. But if anything, I would say the timing was made more uncertain by the way Powell framed it yesterday.
Well, thank you for that. That's a great way of teeing up our future discussion. Let's turn to the review, and then we can talk about actions afterwards. On the FOMC review of monetary policy strategy tools and communications, it was obviously delayed by the crisis. It does seem as if it's on September's plate, and I even hear that we may begin to get some foreshadowing of it in Powell's Jackson Hole remarks. In that regard, there's a lot of talk about makeup strategies and the like. Powell suggested that the review may codify some of the changes that are already being undertaken by the Fed in the Fed statement on long-run goals and monetary policy strategy. So what are you looking for? What are you expecting?
So I think Powell reinforced the notion that they still see the review as important. And even though obviously the context for it is very different. Look, the coronavirus shock has changed the situation importantly, dramatically, relative to what it was when they started the review. Having said that, I think many of the things they're reviewing are still relevant. Perhaps most importantly, the review of the toolkit made it easier for them to take the very dramatic actions they took in March. They have been reviewing all of that, and I'm sure that made it easier for them to react as quickly as they did in March. In terms of the sort of fundamental things around inflation and employment, the track they were on before COVID, I think, is still relevant. As you mentioned, they are moving in the direction of adopting some sort of makeup strategy with respect to inflation that would essentially acknowledge that if inflation is underperformed, that has got to have relevance to how they think about inflation targeting going forward. That's still very relevant going forward. If you think about part of what is going to determine when they raise interest rates is what's the trajectory of inflation. It will be important for them to say that they want to have a makeup strategy, which means if inflation underperforms, that means they're going to want to keep accommodation longer. And so that is very much relevant to the forward guidance debate that we're having now. Similarly, the whole discussion around how you think about the employment side of the mandate is relevant as well. I think before COVID-19, they were stressing the benefits of very strong labor markets. If anything, the emphasis on that has increased. And I think, again, that reinforces what they're going to be trying to do with forward guidance. So I think what they say about those things in this strategic review will be important. The one place I think it's probably not going to be so important is communication. To be perfectly frank, the issues they were discussing there are things they've talked about before, things like potentially having a common forecast for the FOMC, potential changes to the way they present their forecasts. I think those are second-tier issues, to be perfectly frank. They've got bigger fish to fry, and I suspect that's not going to be the most important part of it.
Monetary policy is less effective at the effective lower bound. The Fed has made it clear it's not going to go negative. The Fed's been highly successful in stabilizing financial market conditions, but how impactful it can be in supporting demand, I think right now is a question mark. It seems to me the action needs to be on the fiscal front, that fiscal policy needs to help monetary policies, so to speak. I think Powell made this point yesterday. I assume it's one with which you would agree.
Very much so. Look, there's no question at this point that fiscal policy has much more scope to be effective than monetary policy. I'll come back to what I think monetary policy can do. I don't think they're totally out of ammunition, if you want to put it that way. But the fiscal side is just very critical. One of the things that's just interesting is if you look at the U.S. statistics, retail sales in the most recent month is actually back to a level where it was before COVID-19, whereas virtually every other indicator is at least 10% below where it was before COVID-19. The fact that you can have that big a gap between, say, for example, labor income, which is down 10%, and retail sales be unchanged, the reason that can happen is because of what's been done on fiscal policy. Obviously, as you mentioned earlier, we are facing a bit of a fiscal cliff where if we don't get the so-called fade forward deal, you're going to see a relatively rapid decline in the transfers that are being provided to individuals and the support to businesses. That could be very impactful in terms of near-term aggregate demand. And that's just one way of highlighting the importance of fiscal in the near-term outlook. Look, I think on monetary policy, as you suggest, rates are already very low. In many ways, markets have internalized, I would argue, expectations that the Fed is going to keep rates very low for a long period of time, and therefore the whole structure of U.S. interest rates is bumping up against essentially the zero lower bound. And I think there is a limited degree to which they can push loan rates down further. There is some. I do think they will implement some form of output-based forward guidance that will reinforce the notion that they're going to keep rates low for a very long time. I do think they will do some things with their asset purchases that reinforce the support for lower rates that's coming from that side. But frankly, that's really more about containing the natural tendency of rates to rise as the economy recovers than it is really about lowering rates now. Now, as you mentioned, broader financial conditions are also very supportive. The Fed's 13-3 programs have I would argue, been quite effective, even though they haven't done a lot of transactions in stabilizing credit markets and all of those things. And it's important that they're there, and I think they are providing some support. But as you suggest, fiscal policy is really what's most important, and that's, I think, the thing that's going to really drive the outlook going forward.
Thank you. So you just began to allude to a number of policy options. You mentioned board guidance and asset purchases. And of course, there's yield curve control. Maybe we can take them quickly in turn, even though they overlap. You know, you mentioned that perhaps they would adopt what I would call a state contingent as opposed to a date contingent forward guidance. Just in terms of the market, the dot plot said no rate hikes till 2022. Powell said twice, we're not even thinking about raising rates. Inflation has been undershooting 2% for a long time. It seems to me that while you can fine-tune forward guidance, that the market has the forward guidance it needs for the time being.
I would largely agree with that. Look, first thing to say is they're already providing a form of forward guidance. Their current statement says that they're not going to raise rates until they've weathered the current storm and that the economy is on track so that they can meet their objectives. I would say the market has already largely correctly interpreted that to mean they're on hold for a long period of time until you get some sense that inflation is getting back towards 2% and the labor market is getting much closer to some notion of full employment. Having said that, going forward, we do think the economy is going to recover. And as that happens, there will be a natural tendency for people to sort of bring forward those expectations. And I think there is some utility in the Fed being a little more explicit about what the conditions are under which they might consider raising rates. The issue that seems to be on the table is for them to say they are not going to raise rates until inflation goes above 2%. Governor Brainerd said that, a version of that in a speech recently, and I would argue that seems to be consistent with most of the discussion that's going on with that. I would certainly agree that that is not going to lower rates now, but if you think about the trajectory of rates going forward, I do think that that can contribute to it. But there's still a lot of questions about, do they also have some connection to labor markets? I would argue one of the lessons that they've taken on labor markets recently is they just don't know how tight labor markets have to be before they become a problem. And so I think they're going to be reluctant to tie it to some specific measure of labor markets because they just don't know what those speed limits are. I think there are also issues, frankly, about how you define inflation. That may seem silly, but if you measure it over a longer period than four quarters, that can help them. That is this notion of average inflation targeting. If you say we're not going to raise rates until inflation measured over, say, 3 years goes above 2%, that's a form of average inflation targeting that will reinforce the forward guidance. So I think there's some subtleties around that. I would agree it's not terribly impactful for where markets are right now, but I do think it's important for the trajectory of the economy going forward.
So turning to QE, financial market conditions were steadied largely by Fed activities, particularly earlier this year. Spreads are fairly compressed. You mentioned QE earlier and asset purchases. What more can be done?
So what we don't know at this point is what is the Fed's medium-term strategy with respect to its asset purchases. As you noted, in the sort of stress in March, they very dramatically increased the pace of their asset purchases. They then relatively quickly started ratcheting those things down. In the run-up to the June meeting, we had a little bout where long-term interest rates started to rise, and they very quickly indicated that they were going to maintain the pace of their asset purchases at the current pace. And that seems to have stabilized rates. That was, I think, an important signal, but we still really don't know what their kind of medium-term strategy is. So what we're expecting to get from them is some greater clarity about their approach to all of that. I think it will be tied to containing the natural pressure of long rates to rise as the economy recovers, with the idea of supporting a robust recovery. I think that will be the essence of it. I think there's some additional questions about what exactly is the Fed buying. One of the things that Powell brought up yesterday was this idea that when he thinks of the large-scale asset purchases programs of the that came a decade in the sort of decade after the global financial crisis, he thought of that as buying long-run securities. It was not buying across the curve the way they are now. And so there is this issue of, will part of this adjustment in the strategy involve changing the mix of things that they buy? That's clearly something they're discussing. So one is, what are the objectives of their asset purchases? Two, what is the composition of it? How is that all related to their macroeconomic objectives? Those are all questions which the Fed can tell us more about. And I think that will help the market form expectations for how they're going to behave going forward. I actually think this discussion probably has more immediate impact on rates than the forward guidance discussion. But again, I'm not expecting kind of a dramatic change in the structure of rates from all of this.
A good segue to a question about yield curve control. I was just a simple Treasury guy, not a Fed guy, but it seems to me you can target a quantity or a price. If you target a yield and demand for paper exists at a rate south thereof, you'll get less QE than the central bank intends or desires. Also, the Fed, as I understand it, is thinking about targeting the shorter end of the curve. There were references to Australian practices. But if they're going to target the shorter end, does that mean they're willing to tolerate whatever happens on the longer end? So do you think YCC or yield curve control is in order, and is it in order now?
As you know, during World War II, the Fed pursued what was, I think, generally perceived as a pretty successful strategy of containing Treasury rates across the curve in an environment where you had a huge acceleration of issuance. There were obviously challenges with that. As you suggest, if you control a price, you give up control of quantities, and sometimes that means you'll buy less than you might have thought. At other times, it may buy more. I think the Fed's approach to this, though, has evolved over time. The discussion around yield curve control started before COVID-19. And I think it started in a context where what people were thinking about, frankly, was a relatively mild recession. So if you go back to the world before COVID, I think what people were thinking about was the global financial crisis was unusual. The next recession was more likely to be something like 91 or 2001. And in that context, front-end forward guidance, similar to what the Reserve Bank of Australia is doing, was seen as something that would support forward guidance in an environment where neutral rates were very low. But it was an environment where you're dealing with a relatively mild recession. To be perfectly honest, it doesn't make a lot of sense for what we're dealing with now. One of the things that's actually interesting is we've done this, is you can go back and look at the structure of forward rates in the U.S. and in Australia. And in spite of the fact that the Reserve Bank of Australia is doing front-end yield curve control, the structure of forward rates in the U.S. Treasury markets are actually below the comparable Aussie dollar rates. The Fed has arguably already achieved more than what the RBA has achieved with its forward guidance and yield curve control by just the kind of forward guidance that the Fed is already engaging in. So to be perfectly frank, I think part of the reason the Fed has moved away from that front-end notion of yield curve control is simply the fact that it's not obvious that it would be all that useful to them right now. I think trying to target things at the longer end of the yield curve, while we do have this, what I would argue is relatively successful historical experience with it, the Fed clearly has concerns about the exit strategy. So the problem with that whole approach is that you don't quite know how you're going to get out of it. If you look at the experience with what the Fed did during World War II and the immediate aftermath, there was a period late in that process when upward pressure was starting to come, when the Fed did have to buy more, and I think it's their concern over that is there. Look, I think they have largely moved away from yield curve control as a practical option. So you know, it's still being discussed, but to be perfectly frank, I don't think it's something they're likely to do.
So this week, the Fed has basically extended its credit facilities for a few more months. Take-up's been mixed, which you could view as a sign of success, I guess. I was surprised yesterday not to hear much discussion about the Main Street Lending Program, which was supposed to be a key facility, but there doesn't seem to be much demand at all for that. Should the Fed be concerned about that, or is it not a problem?
I don't think they should be concerned in the following sense. This is not so much a problem of credit supply as it is a shock to the financial well-being of businesses. And to be perfectly honest, it's a very severe shock to the parts of the economy that are most severely affected. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that more credit is really the solution to their problems. So if you've got a business that is facing this dramatic decline in demand because of social distancing and all of that, and the amount of financial support you would need to get to the other side of the COVID-19 shock is so large that it essentially eliminates any equity value in the firm, then more credit isn't really the solution. And so I think what we're finding is that it's obviously important to ensure that credit's available for those firms that can use it and want to use it. But this shock is different, and I think the Fed has done what it can to assure the supply of credit is adequate. And the problems we are facing are ones that are not really about an inadequate supply of credit. They're about fundamental things that businesses are going to have to deal with. And to be perfectly honest, there are a lot of firms who are probably going to be insolvent in a conventional sense, and we're going to have to deal with some form of bankruptcy to deal with all of this. And so I think that is going to be the issue. And that is something that, frankly, the Main Street program can't really deal with.
Okay, thank you. Well, let me ask you a last question and then let you get on to your Nomura work. It's a general question about market functioning, leverage in the economy. The Fed has a dual mandate, but it also has financial stability responsibilities. You know, as you and I worked on, we worked to strengthen capital liquidity in the banking system after the global financial crisis, but there were still many vulnerabilities in the non-bank side. These are outside the Fed's immediate realm. But there was a lot of dysfunction in March in even the Treasury market, and the Fed in its current playbook has had to go well beyond the Bernanke playbook to get into hedge funds, ETFs, munis, high yield, etc. So do we need to strengthen the oversight of non-banks? Do we need to reduce financial sector leverage? And even if your former institution has responsibility for banks and non-banks, what can the Fed do, given that financial instability can spill over to the economy and monetary policy? Does it have something other than its bully pulpit to deal with this?
So I suspect you would agree with me that the structure of financial regulation in the United States is definitely less than ideal.
Absolutely.
We have three major institutions that deal with banks, the Fed, the OCC, and the FDIC. We have two major institutions that deal with securities markets, the SEC and the CFTC. In no rational world would you design that system from scratch. I've long been an advocate of some form of functional regulation as being a more effective way to capture all of these things. And the fact of it is, the politics of all of this in the U.S., which has a very long history, has always seen it as being difficult or near impossible to sort of address it in that way. And so the people who have to deal with this as the responsible officials, you know, you and I have done that at different parts in our career, have to live with this structure. And it is definitely less than ideal. Now, in some sense, the Fed can do what it has the ability to do, which is it can regulate the parts of the financial system that it has direct control over, which is primarily financial holding companies and the largest banks. And it can manage the basic stuff of monetary policy. And I think they have done a good job of that. And the judgment that was made, for example, by the architects of Dodd-Frank was that if you do that appropriately, that can probably be enough. I don't think the problems we've seen in recent months are as bad as you perhaps feel. Yeah, there was some market dysfunction in March, but it was dealt with relatively easily. I would argue that the reason we had that dysfunction was, with 2020 hindsight, a relatively understandable implication of what we did under Dodd-Frank. So partly what we did under Dodd-Frank was make it more costly for conventional market makers, including banks and firms like Maya, to provide liquidity to core markets, including the treasury market. As a consequence of that, other financial institutions moved in, notably hedge funds, to provide what looked like liquidity at the margin. So when a hedge fund used leverage to take advantage of bid-ask spreads in the treasury market or spreads between on-the-run and off-the-run securities, that is in effect providing liquidity to the market. To be perfectly honest, I think people were a little too sanguine about how resilient the liquidity of those markets appeared post-Dodd-Frank, in part because it was being supported by that kind of activity. Now, you get a big shock like COVID-19, and those institutions are going to pull back. And that shows up as a decline in the liquidity of those core markets. I would argue the Fed dealt with that pretty successfully with their asset purchases. And I don't view that as comparable to the problems we had ahead of the global financial crisis a decade ago. I would argue the sort of shadow banking going into subprime mortgages was a more fundamental problem than what we've kind of experienced. So look, I think we very much agree that the current regulatory structure is not what you would design if you were doing it de novo, but it's kind of what we have. And I would argue the sort of post-global financial crisis reforms have largely been successful. The fact that we've come into this COVID-19 shock with the core of the financial system very well capitalized, with lots of liquidity, the fact that we are where we are at this moment in the middle of this, I think speaks to the basic success of those reforms. Look, is it ideal? No. Is there more that should be done? Certainly. But I guess I don't see it as a huge problem.
Well, thank you for that. A debate to be continued. I just would like to wrap up. I want to thank you for offering your fantastic, lucid, illuminating insights. Thank you for joining OMFIF today for this FOMC podcast. Louis Alexander, tremendous appreciation.
My pleasure. It's always good to talk to you, Mark.